You're listening to Iconicast, a science and science advocacy podcast. I am Mike Habrick, and my host is Greg Layden. This is a show about something, and that something is science. For thousands of years, humans have been moving genes around and through and among the chromosomes of plants and animals. We have been shaping our food sources through animal husbandry and agricultural crossbreeding. We have used various methods to do so, including grafting, cross-pollination, and, as Charles Darwin examined in the first chapters of On the Origin of the Species, selection can be a rapid way to affect major changes in form and function of living plants and animals. Genetic engineering is a set of relatively new technologies for modifying DNA to insert, transfer, or move genes. There are cisgenic transfers, meaning within the same or related species, and the more controversial transgenic transfers, which often take unrelated species and share genes through various technologies. Genetic modification is very controversial, and there are movements within the natural foods communities to discredit or ban the use of genetic engineering in food production. Certainly, a movement is afoot to require food labels to disclose any genetically modified contents. Dr. Anastasia Bodner is an expert on genetics and has worked in the field, as it were, concentrating largely on corn. And we want to talk to her about the issues of acceptance of GMOs, largely because the population of our planet is growing so fast, and all of these people are very hungry. When I blogged at Tangled Up in Blue Guy, I wrote some posts questioning GMOs out of my own curiosity, and I did some Google searching. One of the more interesting sites that I found was written by a graduate student at Iowa State University, Genetic Maze. Anastasia Bodner was working on her PhD, since achieved, on genetics in corn. She is currently working for the Department of Agriculture and also volunteers with biofortified.org as policy director. I consider Anastasia a great resource on genetic engineering questions. Welcome to Iconicast, Anastasia.
Thank you for having me.
What are some of the promising avenues of research that is going on towards increasing food production?
Well, of course, the big thing on everyone's mouth right now is CRISPR, with gene editing.
Could you explain that a little bit, what CRISPR is?
Yeah, so with traditional genetic engineering, you know, you're taking a gene from one organism, even if it's the same species, and putting it into another organism for, you know, maybe you're trying to get it to have higher levels of expression or a new trait that species didn't have before. But with gene editing, instead of adding whole gene, you're just editing out a couple of nucleotides in the DNA strand, or maybe you're causing a deletion of a whole gene or making a gene not work anymore. So it's relatively small changes. Mm-hmm. But they can have pretty profound effects if you're targeting very, very carefully. One thing that's really exciting about it and what makes it a really promising avenue of research is that government agencies around the world don't really know how they're going to handle gene editing. If you're only making a couple of nucleotide deletion and you're not adding anything new, does it count as genetically engineered? Does it need to undergo tons of testing? So I think a lot of scientists see a huge amount of promise here where they'll be able to make changes and really improve agriculture and medicine and other things without potentially having to go through a lot of regulatory hurdles. So it'll be interesting to see how the various governments around the world react over the next year or two.
So a new variety of a crop that has been edited by CRISPR might not have to go through as much time in testing for it's able to be produced. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah. So definitely one of the hurdles in getting a crop to market, a biotech crop to market, is making sure that you have all the approvals, not just from the U.S. government, which, depending on what kind of crop it is, you'll need to get approval from USDA, FDA, and EPA. Then you also have to get approval from the Chinese equivalent, the EU equivalent, Japan's equivalent. So it's a pretty huge undertaking, and it can take years or even decades to get all of that work done. But if with using gene editing, CRISPR, and similar technologies, you can create novel genetic change in a targeted way without having to go through all those hurdles, then it could allow us to get some new traits to the market a lot faster.
Anastasia, thanks for coming on.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Great. Yeah. How's the weather?
We just got through digging ourselves out. It was at least 2 feet out there.
You had 2 feet? And where are you exactly?
I'm in Alexandria, Virginia.
Do you know how much they got in D.C. itself?
A little bit less, maybe. I think I saw some reports of like 18 inches.
Yeah, see, that's even a lot for Minnesota.
It's a crazy amount of snow. I mean, even when we were in Iowa, I went to grad school at Iowa State, I don't think that we had a single snowfall this bad.
I just wanted to note something I saw in the news 2 days ago, which I thought was just amazing. South Africa their driest growing season in 100 years, they produced about 50% of the maize that they normally would produce.
That's really sad. Yeah, it's a staple crop there.
Because of climate change, because of dry weather. And I'm not suggesting that there's a GMO solution to that problem, but it is an example of an entire country's major staple crop failing. They'll get their maize from someone else. Someone else probably grew too much maize, and they'll sell it. Mm-hmm. The United States had a great maize crop last year, so we'll just, you know, send it to South Africa, and money will change hands. But what happens when two or three or four countries have the same problem? They can't compensate for each other's loss, and that's...
That happened a few years ago, didn't it, with the rice prices went up because there were, like, really bad monsoons, and then it sort of rippled through the rest of the world, so wheat prices also went up, and then corn prices went up, too.
One of the characteristics of El Nino is that crops go bad in a lot of places in the world at once, and we had these ideas that, you know, we've talked to Emily Cassidy about this kind of thing before, where she's got, you know, the numbers that demonstrate that by about 2030, 2035 is when all of our production reaches our demand. If things stay more or less on course with agriculture and population size and increasing demand within third world countries looking for more meat and that kind of thing. But it's not like we steadily and slowly go to 2030 and then land on this airstrip of inconvenience and then slowly slide into starvation. But what happens is somewhere between now and then, we have an El Nino year, and of the 123 countries that produced maize or and rice and wheat and so on, half of them don't produce as much as normal. And in that 1 year, you have a major food loss event. You know, I mean, I think that we're not looking at a 20 years of grace. We're looking at this can happen this year or next year. It seems to me that we could have some catastrophic event like that. And we had one in Syria. Peter Glick in his research has shown pretty convincingly that the loss of agriculture in Syria was caused by drought, which was in turn caused by climate change. That loss of agriculture forced farmers to move into the cities, and those farmers became the disaffected peasants who created the civil war, and that brought the Syrian state down into the condition of being an unstable or failed state, which has left this giant vacuum. And now the number one foreign policy issue that people are talking about in the world is ISIS. That is a food source, food security related outcome.
Oh, definitely. I think that, I mean, I'm a veteran, and so I tend to have some pretty strong opinions about military related stuff, but I think that it makes sense that if people can feed their children and be reasonably comfortable and not have to worry about where their kids' next meal is going to come from, then you're going to have relative peace. Like, there'll always be some bad guys that'll want to be grabbing power. The population is most vulnerable and susceptible for joining things like ISIS if they're hungry. So to me, we really need to be out there improving agricultural security through extension and teaching programs and helping build up roads and, you know, all the little pieces that need to be put together to help make people food secure. These problems, like with ISIS and other things that are building up, are never going to go away.
And they're never going to be ever local problems either. There are always going to be problems that have ripple effects throughout the rest of the world, even if it does start in a, you know, relatively small country like Syria. The implications are just huge just from that one event.
Yeah. Back when I first joined the Army, it was under Clinton. There were all these initiatives where they would send, basically they'd send farmers who were also in the Army Reserve overseas and have them teach the locals how to gain higher yields. And I think that that's a pretty awesome program. I know it's still ongoing, but I'd like to see a lot more of that.
And did that work? How did that go? American farmers going into a completely different habitat and culture. It seems you often end up in a situation where the outsiders don't know as much as the locals do.
I think that there's definitely, you have to be careful when you do things like that, right? So, you know, in air quotes, industrial farming is fairly consistent. You have fertilizers and pesticides, and you have, you know, reasonable amounts of machinery like plows and things. Then the exact methods you're using aren't as variable than as if you're doing subsistence agriculture. So I think that was what made the Green Revolution such a revolution, is that it brought these techniques that are fairly universal and allowed the farmers to greatly increase their yields. But this does kind of depend on a pretty big influx of capital so that people can buy those supplies at the beginning of the year and can buy things like tractors. So that's definitely not going to work in every situation. I personally would like to see a coordinated effort with some collaboration between organizations like the U.S. military who have the funds and the ability to transport large numbers of people and things like that, and have them combine with local organizations that are able to, you know, pass on information about local agricultural conditions and things like that.
Well, someday we're going to have to get Peter Glick on this show. I had a long talk with him a few weeks ago about California, and I was waiting for him to say, we're all coming to your house because we're going to be climate refugees because the drought is going to continue, and even if the rain happens this winter with El Nino, it's not enough, and so on and so forth. But he basically said, California will continue to grow food at the same scale it does now. They'll just change what they do, when they do certain things, and how they do it, because they're already very much in a modern system technologically. They're already using fully the most advanced technology for agriculture pretty much that's currently used anywhere. So the drought comes along and wipes out Syria, but it comes along in California, but it mostly just changes what they do, how they do things, and when they do it.
My understanding always, too, of genetic engineering has been that it has advantages over other methods of hybridizing and husbandry and that type of thing, in that you're very carefully targeting what genes are being altered, whereas like with standard sexual reproduction, where you're crossbreeding animals, you might get the effect that you need, but you're also potentially getting a whole bunch of other effects as well. And it kind of sounds like CRISPR has potential to be even more precise, like a very much a sharper instrument than what we've had in the past.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different tool in the toolbox. You know, you can't use this to move a large cassette of DNA over, but there's a lot that can be done.
I guess I partly agree and probably disagree. I think that the problem of regulating GMOs is a sort of a separate problem. It has to be streamlined and made more efficient and at the same time effective. The idea that GMOs, because they're plants and plants are our friends, are automatically always safe is crazy, because you could sit down and make a really dangerous plant if you move the genes around, if you wanted to, like intentionally. The very fact that regulatory agencies might be less worried about changing a few base pairs than they are about moving a gene from one plant to another or an animal to a plant makes me realize that they're basically stupid. Because, you know, you can move genes. You take a gene for a globin gene from any animal and move it to any other animal. And you might get a gene that doesn't do much, but you're not going to create a Frankenstein, or you're not going to create an illness necessarily. But take a single base pair out of a globin gene and you have sickle cell anemia. When you just say, I'm going to move a gene, that means absolutely nothing to anyone. And if you say, I'm going to move a specific gene or change a specific gene around, that may actually have a meaning. I would hope that at some point genetic modifications of plants should eventually become the kind of thing, a little bit like in pharmacy, where you make a certain kind of change and we pretty much know what to expect.
It would be really nice to see trait-based regulation, because even if you were using traditional methods like mutagenesis or selective breeding, I could design a selective breeding program for you where it would take a while, but we could probably create something dangerous if we started with the right base stock, like tomatoes that had right. increased solenoid toxins. We really should be looking at the traits and not the method used to get there.
You could probably make a deadly nightshade tomato in a few generations.
Yep.
If you can get the pollen and the ovum together, you might get a hybrid between really distant related plants, and one of them is a deadly nightshade and one of them is a nice heirloom tomato, and you can make a really dangerous BLT.
That kind of brings in this quote that I wanted to read to you and get your opinion on, because it sounds like the researcher that wrote this was really thinking the same thing about how just making those small changes can have huge effects. This is Dr. Michael Antonio, and he's in London. He wrote, in fact, the manner in which GE animals and plants are produced always selects for the splicing of the foreign gene into the regions of the host DNA where other natural genes are trying to work. Given the interdependence of gene function within any group of genes, this random splicing of the foreign gene into the host DNA will always result in a disruption in the normal genetic order in the string of pearls. Therefore, GE of animals and especially plants always results in a loss, to a lesser or greater degree, of the tight genetic control and balanced functioning which is retained through conventional crossbreeding. Is that kind of what we're talking about here, even with the CRISPR, where we're making these minor changes and something and disrupting like a family or even a region of DNA that's interdependent and would have unplanned effects?
I think yes and no. This is a really interesting quote because it's very sciencey, mm-hmm. right? And read for its face value, sure, it's correct. But there's a lot of other things going on that this scientist is not acknowledging.
Like that he's working with plants and not animals. What he says applies pour more to animals than the plants, I think.
Oh, does it? I am definitely not an animal geneticist, so I'd love to hear more from you about that.
Plants don't have homeobox genes. And if you messed around with the positioning and location of homeobox genes, you would get a little monster. In animals, there's a lot of propinquity-related things in genetics. And most genetics, why doesn't matter. But there are genes that are basically expressed in order. And that physical ordering of that expression determines where your head goes.
Really?
Yeah. And so it would be... If you mess with that, you would be, I mean, you wouldn't do that. A genetic researcher making a genetically engineered organism would only do that if that was the point.
So you'd figure it out pretty quick. I mean, all insertion locations are sequenced anyways. Like, we know exactly where things are. So it's not like it would be a surprise. But, yeah, plants don't really care so much where things are. I mean, there's still location effects.
Mm-hmm.
There's some parts of the genome have higher levels of expression based on the types of proteins that are bound there. And things like that. But, yeah, the order doesn't really matter so much.
It's another example of misunderstanding the genetics, maybe willfully, to make it scarier. Because, the positioning of things might matter, but that, in fact, that might matter more than the DNA itself. It might be that the same gene in one place might be different than another place. This is how genes work. This is what we knew. If we really could change how a gene functions by moving it, that would be a great opportunity to change the genetics of an organism.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the random splicing of the foreign gene into the host DNA. I've seen a lot of people who are concerned about genetic engineering focus on this randomness issue. And it's true. Gene editing is giving us some different tools where we can be a lot more precise. And there's ways that you can more closely control where DNA is inserted. But for the most part, you know, using the gene gun or agrobacterium, the insertion site's going to be fairly random. But that's why we do it a lot. I can think of zero cases. I can't imagine anybody would do it this way. No one's going to do one transformation, grow up that plant, and say, okay, this is it. No, you do as many as you can afford to do. So if you're a researcher in a university and you only have a little bit of funding, you might do 30 or 50. And if you're, and then you screen them. And if there's anything weird, then they get thrown away and destroyed. If there are some changes due to the location of the insertion, then those are screened out very quickly.
You don't just throw the results that are dangerous down into the sewer?
No, that's why I clear. Destroyed. Probably with fire. Yeah.
Well.
But, I mean, there's this whole process of breeding and selection that goes along with genetic engineering that I think a lot of people who don't have a background in breeding don't really understand. And I would be willing to bet that this scientist probably doesn't have a background in breeding, even if they're an expert in genetics. If they've never been out there and designed a breeding program in the field, then that gives them a very different perspective.
Did you read that article that I sent you that I got this from? It was from an anti-GMO site that it sounds very sciencey, but there were obviously some things in there that they were either writing misleadingly or from a false assertion of authority, that type of thing, and brought out this. That's where I got this quote from. And I'll actually put the link in the post for the show. I think I can see where it would fool a lot of people or it would mislead a lot of people that were reading that article.
This is why I object to people referring to astrophysicists and cosmologists. All due respect to Neil deGrasse Tyson, I don't care what he thinks about GMOs at all. This is not his field of science. But he's a physicist, therefore physicists know everything. Okay? And then, so he has made arguments, which he's repeated arguments, and also, the other big science cheerleader, Bill Nye, these guys are great. They're out there doing great stuff. But neither of them knows what they're talking about when it comes, neither of them could find their way around in a genetics lab, a genetic engineering lab. They wouldn't know what anything was in that lab. And they have put together arguments that support GMO research, and their arguments are largely complete bullshit. If I may say that on our radio show. Not that their basic argument that GMOs are not the big scary Frankenstein thing, that's fine, but the basis that they use to support that argument, that, for example, we've always bred plants, that really isn't relevant. We're not trying to breed plants. We're trying to go beyond and do more and get more out of it. And yes, there are parallels and similarities, but it's really complicated. Similar to the idea of, well, now they're going to use fewer elements of DNA to make changes, that will be safer. No, it isn't. That is not how DNA works. It has nothing to do with it. You know, I want the arguments to be made by people who actually know what they're doing and understand the genetics. And I'm happy to see people arguing on different sides of this about different issues. And I really do think that new plants should undergo some testing and so on. But when we set up as our cheerleaders, astrophysicists, to represent this case of how to keep the food supply developing and going and safe and so on, then we're really setting up for this guy who claims to be a geneticist writing on this site, who says something that anybody knows anything about genes knows is basically wrong and highly misleading. And it's the same thing. It's just some guy who's got credentials who's saying something that isn't correct, that makes a political point on one side, as opposed to some other guy who has credentials saying something that is also scientifically unsupported, making the opposite political point. And it does none of it's about genes or food.
I agree. I agree.
Well, one thing I just wanted to say real quickly, Anastasia, is I think one of the big dangers, too, is for the general public, when Neil deGrasse Tyson says it or when Bill Nye says it, it just becomes kind of an internet meme, and people just kind of leave it at that without really exploring any further. And that's where somebody that's speaking out of their area of expertise can really do some damage.
Yeah, that's true. I think that most people only really need a meme-level understanding, though. I would absolutely love it if everyone in the world had basic understanding of genetics, you know, both for their own personal health reasons and the health of their children and, you know, so that they can have a better understanding of the world around them. But let's face it, people are busy, and not everybody has the opportunity to learn all the details about these things.
Well, I agree with that, but I know that if I was talking to someone, you know, at Christmas who had heard the Neil deGrasse Tyson argument that GMOs are fine, and I wanted to convince them that he was completely wrong, I could do it.
Because they don't have the background.
I'm not an expert on genetic modification of plants, but I am an expert on the evolution of food crops and food plants and human-plant interaction. So I could easily walk away winning the anti-GMO argument, which I wouldn't do that, but I could easily do that. The meme-level arguments have to be they have to be more solid than they are. They have to be less cavalier. And also, this is why I'm all for labeling, because labeling is not a big issue. We should label everything on everything. It should be labeled with everything, everything. Not just GMOs. Everything you buy, you should be able to find out where it comes from, and it's not a GMO issue at all. And people are not going to not buy GMO crops. I know they're all worried about it, but the people who aren't going to buy GMO crops, they're already not buying them. They're buying organic, and the organic farmers are making a nice buck on that, and good for them for now. It's a very small percentage. I'm a GMO supporter who is completely different in my perspective than most GMO supporters is, in this sense.
Let me step back for just a second and go back to our friend Neil deGrasse Tyson, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Sure.
And Bill Nye as well. As much as I am frustrated with the superficial treatment of science, especially when it's wrong, there's an issue of trust in science communication. And those two guys, for better or for worse, have a pretty big trust bank account with the public. And so if they're saying, hey, this is not scary, even if their underlying rationale isn't quite right, that's a huge, you know, it has a huge important role to play in our societal dialogue. If Neil and Bill are listening to this podcast, call me and I'll be happy to sit down and talk with you over coffee or beer or whatever, and we'll talk about the underlying genetics and then they'll get it right next time. Seriously, though, they're overall forces for good.
I agree with that, and I hope they do sit down and talk with you. And the thing is, like, think about it, an equally superficial sounding argument that Neil deGrasse Tyson makes about aliens coming to Earth. And he makes the point that astronomers for actually centuries have been looking up at the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't noticed this. So it's basically, you can never prove the absence of something, it is said by the person, the slightly less thoughtful person. I think that astronomers looking at the sky for centuries, not seeing a single alien, is a good argument. And that's sort of a surface meme level argument. And people, when they hear that, they go, oh, yeah, and that makes sense. I just wish that Neil and Bill and others would make that kind of argument that's just basically more based on what really happens. And also, I also don't see the argument being made sufficiently, partly because the industry hasn't produced enough yet about the urgency of addressing issues in food security and food supply.
Yeah, that's a huge problem.
I mean, there hasn't been a genetic revolution equivalent of the green revolution in food yet, and there may not be, but we're kind of hoping there is one, aren't we?
But I think that the problem is that there's so many small things. So the green revolution was successful, you know, like we mentioned before. The green revolution was successful because it took basically subsistence agriculture and introduced fertilizer, pesticides, and heavy machinery.
And a few really important varieties, new varieties of some kind.
That's true. That's true. That's a very important part. But even without the new varieties, you know, just adding fertilizer can make a huge impact. So yeah, the switch from tall, weak wheat plants to short, stronger wheat plants where the seeds didn't fall on the ground whenever you tried to harvest them. That made a pretty big difference, too. But I'm having a hard time seeing something that would make such a huge worldwide improvement, where those improvements would be as applicable in Central America as they would be in India. Uh-huh. So instead, the problems that we have now are there's a small problem here and there's a small problem there, and so they add up, but you can't point to it and say, here's the success story. You know, because it's not one, it's many.
Are we still thinking it's possible to return into agricultural use land that has largely been put fallow because of salination and arid environments?
I think that probably dealing with salinity is probably easier than dealing with drought. Well, both, in both cases, there are people working on salt-tolerant plants and then plants that can withstand longer periods of drought than the normal crop varieties. So that's one of those things where that should be done. Disease resistance across many crop species is definitely needed, from cassava to bananas, wheat, tons of different diseases that we need to deal with. And then there's some really kind of out there research where they're trying to basically help make plants that can process sugars faster, so they'll accumulate. I don't know if that's really going to happen, but.
What would that do? Would that grow faster then, or what would be the benefit of that?
Would get your ethanol faster?
So it has to do with the way that carbon dioxide is fixed by the plants.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the molecules in the plant that turn carbon dioxide into sugars. And so some plants do it one way and some plants do another way. And so there's some efforts to try to make some important crop plants do it the faster way.
Are you talking about C3 versus C4 versus CAM pathways?
Yes.
And is C3...
attempting to not be too jargony.
Right. So in less jargonistic terms, there's a trade-offs in all these biological systems. And one of the trade-offs is surviving in different environments. And most grass is either C3 or all grass is either C3 or C4.
Mm-hmm.
And C4 is tropical and C3 is not tropical. And one in origin, of course, corn is a tropical grass that we grow in Minnesota. So it's a C4 plant. And so if you could convert a C4 plant into a C3 plant, just because there's been this trade-off in evolutionary history, which is not much of a trade-off, but is enough to matter, you could get that plant to just, yeah, it would become ripe faster or make more sugar sooner or something.
Mm-hmm.
If we could get a plant to capture carbon and turn it into a solid mass that we can either eat or bury in the ground or burn, that would be a great thing really related to climate change. And we could just make plants better carbon sinks.
Yeah, but I think people have been working on converting C4 plants to C3 for a long time and hasn't really, I don't think I've seen any research that's been like really promising.
But with this new, more targeted genetic change research, that might be.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see if anybody's trying to apply these new technologies to this long-term problem.
I'd like to return to the issue of labeling, because Greg brought it up earlier, but I was going to ask this anyway. And part of the reason I wanted to bring it up was that Campbell's recently stated they will be labeling their foods whether or not it's genetic. And there's been a discussion over whether or not there would be a benefit to food labeling or whether it would be a deterrent for people to buy foods that wouldn't be necessarily dangerous. But are there ways to educate the public on food with regard to GMO content of food products that would lead them to make informed decisions? And I'll bring in my idea. You know, I kind of think that there should be information on what goes into producing food, but there's not enough room on cans. There's not enough room on the boxes or anything like that. You got to also disclose how much sugar is in there, you know, what the ingredients are and what sodium content is. And pretty soon you're going to be sending encyclopedias, you know, with your box of Cheerios. But my idea is if they want to do something, maybe they could have like a QR code or a barcode or something that people could read with their phone, and that would lead to information on if there is some genetic engineering, what type of genetic engineering for it, what kind of potential benefits it has, and that type of thing. And I'm wondering if that's something that may be a way to solve the issue where it would help people to accept GMOs at the same time satisfy people that are for labeling.
I definitely see some positives there. I mean, I like more information. So I would love to see producers voluntarily label what their practices were. But there's some really big issues with that. Mm-hmm. One of the main ones being that anything that's commodified, that's not going to work. If you have like a really basic product like corn flour, okay, it only has one ingredient. But the corn in that package of corn flour might be from, it's been accumulated from many, many fields and put into huge boxcars on trains and giant silos. So even if one farmer says, you know, is able to track, which, you know, each farmer knows what kind of seed they buy. They know what kind of pesticides they used. You know, they know what kind of fertilizer they use, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one farmer says, I'm going to provide that information voluntarily. Okay, what about the other ones that all contributed to that silo full of corn? You have to get that information from everybody. What if that information is different? Farmer A decided to use BT corn because he had a high pest pressure from the particular insects that BT controls, but one of the other farmers didn't. So now you have to say, okay, the corn in this package of corn flour may contain the BT trait. It may have been sprayed by glyphosate. They may have used this kind of fertilizer. So at some point, it's like, okay, how is that useful?
Mm-hmm.
I think that generally providing science-based information about food and other products, I'd like to see it for T-shirts, for, you know, wood products, you know, everything that I buy. I would like to see more information, especially as far as the environmental impacts. But as far as anything that's a commodity where things get bulked, you end up with these may contains, and it just seems silly to me, unless it's something that was done in, like, a small batch, or if it's, like, a single product, like an apple.
I can see what you're saying, because I grew up in a very small town where farming was the main thing, and my dad was a farmer, and he'd bring the wheat in from the field and take it to the elevator, and, you know, then when he dumped it in, basically it was just going into, like, the bin, same bin that farmers from other fields, maybe on the other side of the county, might be bringing them into. So now that really makes sense how difficult it would be to trace back and say yes, or pretty much impossible because it all gets mixed together from my dad's neighbor's farm or from my dad's farm is a different one. I can see definitely how it would be pretty much impossible to figure that out.
So they have basic characteristics, you know, so like for wheat, there are a couple of different varieties, right? There's red wheat, winter wheat, and regular wheat. And for corn, there's number two, yellow dent corn, and that's what everything is. And then there's other varieties that you might use for different purposes, like something that might have better qualities for ethanol or something. So I had this idea a couple years ago. I blogged about it. I really need to update that post and rewrite it into the context of labeling that we have today. I think the post was titled Towards a Better Agriculture for Everyone. It's on biofortified.org. My idea was if some organization, like maybe the grocery manufacturers organization, somebody that is pretty big and has their fingers into most of our food, came up with some sort of a scoring system that was preferably science-based, and they could tell us the environmental impact of the crop. So the corn that they sourced from Farmer Joe, all the methods that they used would meet some level, some numeric score based on the methods that they used. Like if they were using no-till agriculture, and they planted a cover crop to prevent erosion, those would get a higher score than farmers who didn't, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the box of corn flakes or the package of corn flour or whatever, you could say made with corn that has a environmental score of 90 or higher out of 100, you know, out of 100%. And that would potentially be a way to aggregate those may contains. Because you'd just have the silo say, okay, well, I'm only going to buy from you if you can document that your environmental practices mean that your product is a 80% or 90% or something.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably, you know, somebody like me who's concerned about the environment, I want to go to the store and I'd check my, just like I check the calories, I check the price, and I want to make sure that my product tastes good. I'd look and say, oh, well, you know, the E-score for this one is only 80, and this one's only a couple pennies more, so I'll buy the one that's 95. Okay.
Yeah, I've been thinking we should have a C-score, which is similar to that, which would involve how much fossil carbon is used to produce this product.
Yeah, and actually that's actually a pretty similar idea, only I think that as much as carbon is incredibly important, I think that there's other things to worry about, like how agriculture has an impact on our water quality and things like that could be included.
It reminds me a little bit of rating movies. Remember when I was a kid, the Catholic Church started rating movies. They would tell you what movies you weren't not allowed to see. And that led eventually to the R rating, G rating, GP rating, GP-13 rating system we have now. And there's the V-chip, which I don't know if anyone really uses that or not, but it's this thing where someone has decided what movies your kids can watch. And you give it a ranking, and then it controls what your TV can show. And the problem with that, all those methods, is that it comes down to a very small number of people deciding what your values are.
Mm-hmm.
And really what should be happening is every product or movie or whatever should have a unique code. And then anybody who wants to can provide a ranking system.
Kind of like Rotten Tomatoes does?
If there's a strong group of people that really has resources and says GMOs, you should never touch them. They can be in charge of telling everyone whether or not there's GMO in some food. They can figure out how to do it. And anybody who wants to say we have to reduce the amount of carbon that goes in the atmosphere can figure that out. Or a general environmental score, which I think is a good idea, can be done. And not everything would have to score, but things can. Just like the Organic Farming Association now, right? Don't they? Yeah, they have official rules and you have to follow them.
Yeah, and actually that's sort of the biggest thing that organic has going for it, is that it's a consistent set of rules. And when you see, okay, so let me step back for a second. Okay, so theoretically, when you see the organic seal on a product, it means something. It means that the producer had to follow all these rules. Right. Whether or not that is actually happening in practice, I don't know, because they contract out to all these different certifiers and they're coming from different countries and stuff like that. But theoretically, those products follow these certain rules.
I think an organic or healthy eating organization that could produce a better rating than organic farming would do well, because the organic farming rules not only may not be followed all the time, but they might also be completely out of date and ridiculous in some ways.
And that's sort of my point, is that the organic rules are very arbitrary. They're based on natural, not natural, which, as we all know, we can think of lots of things that are natural that are not good, mm-hmm. and lots of things that are synthetic that are very good. And so if some committee of scientists or committee of experts or something could come up with this other, some sort of E score, or maybe multiple groups, you know, so like there, for a while there were competing fair trade labels, right? There was some main fair trade organization right. going around certifying stuff, but I remember seeing there were quite a few different types of labels on that subject area, and they competed, just like kosher. And there's a great blog post about kosher labels on BioFortified as well by Mary Mangan that looks at, there are hundreds of different kosher labels, and they all have their own rules, and people choose the ones that they trust and buy those products, that that's what they're concerned about. And so I think that there's potential for some sort of environmental labeling, whether it's carbon-based or water-based or a combination or whatever. To me, that would be far more meaningful than GMO, non-GMO. I think voluntary labeling of non-GMO or GMO, whatever, it's fine as long as it's voluntary.
Some kind of, you know, barcode. I thought that was my idea, Mike. But anyway, the barcode or QR code kind of thing.
A couple people have said that, yeah.
The question of voluntary versus non-voluntary is interesting. We had a law passed here in Coon Rapids, which actually got rescinded right afterwards for completely ridiculous reasons. But the law said, if you're going to buy gas at a gas station, you have to pay in advance with your credit card at the machine or walk in with cash.
Oh, yeah, that's the law. Do that.
Well, not every state has that statewide, and out here in the Midwest, we don't have that rule, generally speaking. You can go in and pay with cash after you buy. Most places in the Midwest, except for in some cities. The thing is, a gas station can make up the rule themselves. They can say that you pay before you buy, but then people will go to other gas stations. So yeah. between the fact that the city police was supposedly taking more calls for people stealing gas and for anything else, any other crime, and the owners all wanted this rule. They wanted the rule imposed on themselves in order to avoid having to be the guy who says, oh, we're going to be jerks, you got to pay first. Everyone actually wanted the regulation.
Really?
Yes, they wanted it. Or not everybody wanted it. It's not, a lot of people just don't want any regulations no matter what, and they, you know.
But it puts the gas stations at risk.
No, it doesn't, because they all wanted to do this.
No, but I mean, feeling the market pressure to not make people pay in advance puts them at risk. So they wanted the regulation so everybody would have to do it.
Exactly. They wanted
everybody in Coon Rapids.
Well, the thing is, they got rid of the rule for some other reason. And I suppose if you live in Blaine, you could go, you know, whatever. The point is, with the Campbell's Soup thing, I mean, that's in a way an example where an industry has regulated itself, knowing, you know, it's going to happen anyway, or it's going to be variable by state, or California is always going to be the jerk state and make you regulate and so on. And so, you know, what are you going to do? When I heard that rule, we've had a cold going around in the house the last couple weeks. And so I was actually going to buy some chicken soup, because all science-based people know that chicken soup works, even though there's no science behind it. In fact, studies have shown that it does work, but no one knows why, so we can't say it really works. But anyway, and of course, they were out of chicken soup because the whole city has this disease, because basically Christmas happened and everyone went and exchanged diseases. But the point is, I could hardly find any – I was thinking about the GMO labels. I'm thinking, which – Campbell's soups would have a GMO label. Like, what are the GMO crops that would be in these soups? And of course, the main one would be corn. I'm thinking, soups are things that don't have corn.
And even if it does have corn, it's sweet corn. It's sweet corn. It's usually not genetically engineered.
Right. There's no corn syrup used in most of these products. There might be some, but they can basically get away. They can be the industry that steps forward and say, we don't care about labeling. We're fine. We'll label because we don't use it.
The only things that they're going to have is soy lecithin and like corn starch.
And they can put labels on some things, or they can just maybe avoid GMO. I mean, they're big. They probably have the ability to, in terms of the commodities product market, they probably have the ability to buy stuff and for that those few uses and not use it.
Do you know if Campbell's was including animals fed biotech crops?
I bet they weren't.
I bet they weren't as well, because there are a lot of meat in Campbell's soup. So
well, their chicken noodle soup has chickens.
Yeah, so I doubt it would say, oh, by the way, we fed our chickens GMO.
Good question. That's a good question.
But the labeling, I think it does, you know, imposing it, I think, does make it kind of expensive in a lot of different ways without really any necessarily scientific need for it. You know what I mean?
I think the expense varies, though. Like, in some cases, like Greg was saying, if Campbell's wanted to become GMO-free, it'd be pretty easy, just like Cheerios.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you make Cheerios GMO-free, well, that's pretty easy because oats are there's no genetic modified
right.
version.
Right.
So whatever, it's no problem for them. Mm-hmm. What bothers me, there's this thing, the non-GMO project, and if you look at the grocery store, you're going to see a whole ton of products that have this little monarch butterfly on it, and that's indicating it's a non-GMO certified by this particular organization. And, you know, good for them. They carved out their little market share, you know, are providing this service. But they charge. So, like, every product you see is paying this organization. It's not a huge amount, but they're still paying this organization yearly for those labels on every product that gets passed on to the consumer. So I'm less concerned when I see a product that says voluntarily GMO or non-GMO than I am with a product that has that particular label on it, because that particular label has a known cost associated with it. And we know that that provides no safety benefit, no health benefit. It's just a cost.
See, I would argue that those certifying organizations, which already exist for everything, like UL, for example, they don't work for free. Nothing.
But they actually do safety, though.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that they're not more legitimate. I'm just saying that the paying part is going to be part of this no matter what. And hopefully there would be the ones that actually do something useful would rise to the surface and be the ones that actually become legitimized. We might be a little different than that. You might be a little more anti-regulation and me a little bit more pro-regulation. I don't have a problem with it being regulated except for one thing. And that is whether it's a government regulating it or whether it's a company that comes in and ends up being like Underwriters Lab, but for health and food, they're both going to become institutionalized, out of date, and ineffective within months or years. And it's going to be then a cost and a thing that doesn't work that well. For example, food labeling as it is now has become yet less useful than it was when it was first implemented. The two kinds of labeling that have been regulated are what is in your food and what is the relative cost of this food.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those have become useless to most consumers most of the time, even except for the labels that say, this has a known bad thing in it for certain people. Those labels stand out a bit more. But, you know, Huxley has a mild allergy to walnuts, and I spend a lot of time reading labels, and I have no real confidence that I have found the word walnut or not in that label.
Mm-hmm.
When it's 800-900 words on a label.
That's really frustrating.
It's not helping. It's required, and it doesn't help at all. Okay, so I'm not against government regulation. I just want it to be done right, and I don't think that most of these agencies, if one agency emerges as the one that does it, that's not the government, or if the government does it, they're not going to do it right. What I would like to see is one government regulation. You know how all electronic instruments that can communicate with each other have a MAC code?
Yeah.
I want a MAC code for food. That's all. Just that. And then if anyone does anything with it, they can, and then people can do stuff with it.
Yeah. You know, I would love to talk about regulation for a moment, if you guys don't mind.
Yeah, go ahead.
So Biofortified, or Biology Fortified is the full name of our organization. I recently submitted a comment to the White House's Office of Science and Technology Policy, who is embarking on a rewriting process of the Coordinated Framework for Regulation of Biotechnology. And this coordinated framework came out in the 80s. And basically what it said was that existing regulations was enough. So the way that the FDA regulates food, if something is adulterated or if it has, you know, additives that need to be examined because we haven't been eating them in the past, that's how they regulate biotech. And the USDA, they regulate biotech based on existing rules about plant pests. So if a biotech plant could potentially have plant pest problems, you know, make it more pesty or cause disease or something like that, then they regulate it. And the EPA regulates pesticides, so anything related to pesticides, then they regulate that. But that's kind of a wonky system, you know? So other countries came up with a new agency that looks at biotech, and in total, all of its different aspects, you know, considers it in a very different way than the U.S. does. And there's definitely pros and cons to doing it these different ways, but I definitely encourage your listeners to take a look at what the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House is doing and submit your public comments. There's going to be some public meetings coming up in the next couple months where you can participate, listen in to the meetings, and provide information. And it's kind of important. My recommendation from BioFortified was that they really should consider some advisory committees and bring in some non-governmental scientists to help provide needed expertise and, you know, some more diverse input, you know, and maybe provide some across-the-board input, not just to one agency, but to look at the total product. But now actually is probably a really good time for me to give my disclaimer. So I actually do work for the USDA. I previously worked for the regulatory agency that regulates biotech in the USDA, although I don't work for them any longer now. I work for a different agency there. So, of course, I'm not speaking for the USDA in any way, shape, or form, and I'm just here as myself.
Do you find that there is a lot of resistance to GMOs, or do people seem generally curious about what they are, what they do, and what their benefits are?
I think it depends. I think there was some point about 2 years ago where I just decided I wasn't going to deal with people's bullshit. Like, just to be blunt. So, I mean, I'm not going to go into an organization where I know they're going to be like 100% anti-GMO and I'm not going to have any effect.
Mm-hmm.
So I try really hard to find opportunities where I can talk with people either on a one-on-one basis or, you know, to a group where it's folks that genuinely want to know more. So I think that I'm insulating myself. So I don't know how widespread Food Babe's army is in reality in the United States. But I do know that the groups that I've talked to have been very receptive. I spoke to a skeptics group last year. That was pretty awesome here in the D.C. area. I went to an event run by the Maryland Farm Bureau, and they invited, like, foodies from the area. That was pretty cool. Similarly, I went to one in Kansas City where it was run by the Farm Bureau, and they invited foodies. Those and other examples, I had lots of really tough questions where people really want to know, like, is this safe? You know, do I need to be worried about with this with my kids? And I appreciate that because there's stuff that I hear about and I'm like, oh, crap, is that going to affect my daughter? I need to know. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not just an academic question anymore. Like, now I have a kid and I really have to think about if it's going to have an impact on her and her little brain cells and all that stuff. So I can definitely appreciate people's concern. And usually when you explain the science, you know, and try not to be too jargony and stuff, I've found that people are very receptive. But again, like I said, I may not be speaking to the broadest variety of people, so I don't know if everyone is receptive or not.
Well, as long as you feel you're being effective with the people that you talk with, I think that's the important part. But broader, I mean, we see on Facebook there's a lot of disagreement with our views on the safety of GMO. Even in the GMO LOL group or something like that on Facebook, there's a lot of examples of stuff that's out there. But I was kind of wondering, when you actually get out there as part of your outreach, what you're running into. So I'm glad to hear that you know, you're getting good reception. And finally, I did want to ask you, do you know what the current status of the production of golden rice is? Are we starting to see a vision yet? Or what's happening with that?
I think the people in the U.S. are not as engaged with government decisions as they could be. So, like, we have the Federal Register website. It could be better organized. It could be more user-friendly. But the government, generally, if something's happening, puts out a notice and tells everyone. So when USDA is going to deregulate a biotech crop, they let everybody know. And so people have an opportunity to go comment. It's usually online, and so they have to type something out. But I think in other countries, particularly where they want to be doing golden rice, like in India, not through some sterile website like the Federal Register site. It's like people go to community meetings. And so there have been a couple of examples where anti-GMO activists have like totally swamped government meetings where they were trying to talk about safety of biotech products. For example, the BT eggplant. This just happened in the last couple of years. And the government had done all of its tests and figured out, yeah, it's safe. And it looks like it's a pretty good product. We're going to go ahead and let farmers start using it. Anti-GMO swamped the forum, didn't even let the scientists speak, and really caused some problems in the process. And so I think that that is, has a lot to do with what's going on with golden rice.
There are some very serious problems going on if we look outside the United States in the relationship between scientists, government, the general public, and responsibility.
Yeah.
And scientists were jailed in Italy because they said, we can't tell you if there will be an earthquake here. And the government interpreted that as, they're telling us there won't be an earthquake here. Then there was an earthquake. This is a town that had been evacuated because of an earlier earthquake, and people went back into the town. There was an earthquake. People were killed. Scientists were put on trial and convicted of essentially the equivalent of, you know, killing lots of people.
It's just insane.
And they had said, we don't know. They had said, we can't say. They didn't say that it was safe to go back into the town.
Right. I don't know. That's very frustrating. I mean, because the right response was we don't know. I mean, you can never predict 100% what's going on with earthquakes or anything, really. So that's the big problem. You know, I think that the whole regulatory process and, you know, interference from non-scientific organizations and things like that. You know, it's important to talk about socioeconomic issues when we're dealing with things like agriculture, but to have that be able to totally stop a process seems a little extreme to me. But the other thing that's happening is that they've been trying to do some final field studies. You know, they need to transfer the biotech trait into local rice varieties so that the farmers can grow them. And they need to do some trials to make sure that once they've done that breeding process, that the trait still works and is effective. Just those basic processes have been slowed dramatically. And so I think that it's kind of crazy how long it's taken. You know, partly it's due to science takes a while, but a lot of it seems to be outside influence, and it's just tragic.
Yeah, and there was this one incident in the Philippines. It was about 3 or 4 years ago where there were some test fields or research fields of golden rice corn where local activists, or not even necessarily local activists, had come in and destroyed the crops before they could even really be tested. And it seems to be we run into a lot of that when it comes to genetic engineering.
Yeah.
So we're still waiting. We're trying to get it going, huh?
Still waiting. But as far as I know, there are some other golden things that have had some success. So Ed Buckler's lab up in Cornell University, in collaboration with many other folks, used marker-assisted selection. So it's traditional breeding in combination with computational genetics, basically. And they were able to make maize, corn, with very high levels of vitamin A. And so they could release that immediately. It didn't need to be regulated since it was traditional breeding, technically. So that's already been having some successes. And then the other one is orange sweet potatoes. So even though the sweet potatoes that we're used to in the United States are orange, in Africa, the ones that they grow are white. And so simply switching those out with an orange variety can have a huge positive impact when it comes to vitamin A production and the people that eat them. And so as far as I know, that's already been happening. Even though golden rice has been stalled, there have been other examples of beta carotene in foods that have been successful.
Have you ever eaten golden rice?
No, I haven't.
I was wondering what it tastes like.
I know. So I frequently think about this. So I did research on corn, and it's funny that you mentioned globins earlier, Greg. Mm-hmm. Because my research, I don't know if I've told you about this, I overexpressed corn globin in corn in hopes that the corn would then also increase production of heme and then put iron in it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, okay.
We actually just had a paper come out last year, 2 years ago, where it showed it was sort of our results were inconclusive, unfortunately. I think that there was some promise there. But anyway, I always wondered, could I eat my corn? Like, would somebody... would I be breaking a law? Like, I don't even know.
There's a history of that in science. People, you know, inventing something and trying it on themselves. Salk gave himself his first vaccine, I think.
Yeah.
I think ether might have been. The guy who invented heroin was really into heroin, apparently.
Oh, dear.
I don't remember what it was now. But it would be like that. I mean, you could go down in the textbooks, especially if something went really badly wrong.
Like Dr. Hyde.
So And right. The other stuff that we had was we were expressing green fluorescent protein in jellyfish and corn.
Uh-huh.
And it was like, it was really pretty. But I mean, if we had been using biotech to alter a taste component, like our expected outcome was taste, I think I probably would have tasted it, but they weren't expected to have an impact on taste. So I didn't feel a huge need to eat it.
I definitely would have tried it.
You know what I did try? This is probably going to sound a little gross, but have you heard of huilacoche? Corn smut? It's a
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yes. I know that.
Yeah.
That's important. That's an important food in a lot of in Bolivia and a lot of other places in South America. It's very much involved in our, and it's incorporated in a lot of, you know, religious rituals and so on. And so,
actually,
in other places, it's just an important food. It's when your corn goes bad and you eat it anyway. It's like a corn truffle.
I gotta look that up. So it's a pest in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, people, I mean, you spray fungicide if you have this corn smut. But anyways, so on my transgenic plant, sometimes I would see smuts growing and I just wanted to taste it because I heard about it being this effectively a corn truffle. And so I have eaten corn smut that has been growing on my transgenic plants before. And they're delicious.
Oh, that was good, yeah. And the thing is, a corn smut is a kind of fungus, right?
Oh, yeah.
So it's actually more closely related to humans than it is to plants.
Yeah, I always thought that was interesting.
Yeah, so that's where the gene moves into the, from the corn, moves into the fungus, and that's what creates your Frankenorganism.
I wonder if, you know, it seems like practically every day there's a new paper about horizontal gene transfer or some sort of crazy thing that happened in nature, genes moving back and forth. I wonder if corn smuts have accumulated genes from corn and if they've accumulated any transgenes.
That's a good question.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. I'll have to ask around. I'm sure somebody's working on it. That's an interesting thought.
I don't think that we can really afford to turn our backs on any possible technology that has the potential to revolutionize agriculture and be able to produce enough food to feed such a huge population as we expect to see within the next 35 years. Genetic modification is not the answer, but I think that it has the potential to do great good. We still have the question of how to slow the population growth and the economical question that still bothers me. By producing more food, are we going to encourage faster population growth? Do we have the infrastructure and marketing system to distribute more food? And I want to thank Anastasia for being on the show, and we hope that our audience has enjoyed listening to it.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.